Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
I have never, to the best of my knowledge on this show, talked to a numismatist. And I don't even know if I'm saying that word right, but I'm going with it. That is someone who is an expert in coins and things like that. And the reason we're going to is because there are apparently a bunch of phony toonies floating around in our money system right now. Would you be able to tell the real one from the fake one? I'm not sure I would, but I bet my next guest, the numismatist, Brett Mackey, is a coin collector and counterfeit currency expert, joins us now. Brett, how are you today?
I'm doing great. How are you today?
I'm great. Do you go by numismatist? Is that on your business card?
Sure. Let's go with that.
It's a great word. I love it. I've just never heard it even before. So I am looking at some pictures online of these fake toonies that are apparently out there, and I'll be very honest, unless they feel different, I would never in a million years think I was holding a fake toonie by looking at it.
You and 99% of the rest of Canadians, that's absolutely correct. They're that good.
So, okay, before we get into the coin itself and what are the differences and stuff, the first thing that came to mind when I heard this story is I could kind of understand someone counterfeiting a $100 bill because the effort you put in and, you know, whatever, it's worth your while, I guess. It seems like an awful lot of work to put together toonies for little payoff. Why is someone doing this?
Well, if you're just making one toonie or a small number of toonies, you're absolutely right. It's not going to pay off. You know, the amount of effort and the costs far outweigh whatever payoff you're going to get from counterfeiting a few toonies. However, with these toonies that we're talking about today, we're calling them the camel toe toonies because of the identifying feature on them. With these toonies, so many of them have been made and put into circulation that you're making money hand over fist with these things. They're being produced at maybe 50 cents a piece, if that, probably even less. And the rest of that is all profit once it gets put into circulation.
Made out of the same materials that regular coins would be made of?
Very, very similar. Very, very similar. It would be indistinguishable to 99.9% of Canadians.
And indistinguishable by look or also by feel?
Both.
Really? So for you, as an expert, if I blindfolded you and put two of these, one real, one fake in your hand, would you be able to tell the difference?
Nope.
Amazing.
My identification of these things would be visual. There's one key visual element that you can tell which one's fake, which one's real. There's a bunch of other minor factors, but there's one key element that is the differentiator that's on all of the counterfeit toonies.
All right. I got a feeling that after you named this this phony one, a whole lot of people went, wait a second, what is on this loony? What is on this toonie? Why are you calling it the camel toe toonie? Maybe we better explain what that means.
That's a good idea. So on the counterfeit toonies, the polar bear's front right paw is kind of split like a cloven hoof sort of thing, or like a camel's toe. Okay, so that's where we get the name from it. It looks like the toe of a camel, this big, wide, hoofed pad sort of thing. And it's very, very distinctive. You can tell this feature from a genuine one, even at a distance, unless you've got terrible eyesight. But it's very easily distinguishable. It's on all of the counterfeit toonies, and easy to see. And it's guaranteed that if you see that polar bear's foot, or the camel toe, if you will, it is a counterfeit toonie.
So, okay, I know you're not one of the counterfeiters, but I'm asking you to get into the head of the counterfeiters. If you know that this makes it distinguishable, why not just get rid of that distinguishing feature and make it like the others?
Well, there could be lots of reasons, but the one that I think is probably the most plausible is it might be their signature.
All right, all right. So they want it to, it's intentional just to show, okay. The rest of it, though, so I'm looking at this picture. So the polar bear looks very similar and maybe identical. I mean, the pictures that I've got, it might be one's a little dirty or something for some of the markings, but they look very close. The queen, though, on the back, in the real one, she's wearing a crown and she's got a smaller head. In the other, is that very different, or was this just a later model? The fake one is matching a later model toonie.
So the portrait of the queen on our coins, we've had four different portraits of the queen on our coins since 1952. The one with the crown that you're referring to there is actually the third portrait of the queen, and the one without the crown that you're also looking at is the fourth portrait of the queen, and that changed in about 2003. So any coins dated 2002 or earlier feature that crowned portrait, and any coins dated 2004 or later feature the uncrowned portrait. And anything in 2003 could be either one. So those are two genuine, or at least plausible or realistic portraits that appear on all genuine coins.
Okay, so I don't know the law around this. Let's say I go to a store and I buy something and they hand me a toonie and I go home and, well, as you're talking right now, people at home have pulled them out to say, oh, I've got a couple toonies in my pants, in my pocket, and they see that they have what now they believe to be a fake toonie. Are they obligated at that point just to throw it out? Like, what can you do with it? Can you go back to the store and say, you gave me a fake, I got to get it back? What do you do if you're suddenly holding a bunch of these?
Well, if you're holding a single counterfeit toonie, or a suspected single counterfeit toonie, or a small number of them, my suggestion would be go to your bank and say you got this coin in your change somewhere along the road, you believe it to be counterfeit, and you'd like to get some genuine coins for it. The bank may, at their discretion, give a swap for you and give you some genuine coins. They might not. Because literally, it's not their responsibility to make sure that the coins that you have are genuine, especially if they didn't give you the coins in the first place.
Right.
But that's my first suggestion. Go to your bank, say you've got some suspected counterfeit toonies, you'd like to exchange them for real ones, see what they say. Worst case scenario, they refuse. You can try going back to the store you got it from, try that as well. And you can try their luck. And if that doesn't work, just throw them out. They're not worth anything. And if you try and spend them deliberately, you're going to get in trouble,
That's right.
or at least you'll be committing an offense.
So do we have any reason to believe? I know that a lot of the, well, a number of these have been found around Brant County, that in particular. Do we have any reason to think these originated in this area, or they've just made their way through the system and got here now?
So these coins have been circulating in Canada since about 2020. So they've been around for multiple years. And there are many, many, many of these things to the order of suspected 5 to 10 million across the country.
Holy cow.
And they originally surfaced in the Greater Toronto Area and have since been found coast to coast. So they're definitely widely available. Brant County just happened to have been a recent report, and I've read the same article that you did, but it's certainly not a major problem there compared to other areas. I'd say the hot spot is probably the Greater Toronto Area,
But if
and
it got to Brant County, inevitably they're going to end up in Hamilton at some point if they haven't already. They probably have
oh,
already.
I guarantee they're already in Hamilton.
One last thing before I let you go, because we're short on time.
Sure.
When you talk about 5 to 10 million, so that explains, let me go back to the very first question. Now it explains why somebody would go to the trouble of doing this, because clearly that's an awful lot
Exactly.
of money. But that also would seemingly require an industrial scale equipment situation. Like, this is not something you could do in your basement, right? This would have to take some space.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's suspected through just general common sense and that sort of thing, as well as what the police have been releasing, that these are coming from China. And if you know anything about China, you'll know that they are quite happy to counterfeit anything, whether it's jeans or coins or perfumes or bags or whatever. And they have no problem letting it happen and letting it get exported into other countries such as Canada. So that's where we believe they're all coming from, and they're being made for pennies on the dollar.
That is Brent Mackey. Fascinating stuff, Brent. I really appreciate it. He is a coin collector, counterfeit currency expert. Keep an eye out for the toonie. When you're home, when you're looking in your pockets, look for the toonie. Look at the polar bear. And if he's got two very clear toes at the front of his foot, as opposed to just sort of a rounded foot, you probably have a forged counterfeit toonie. Brent, really appreciate you doing this. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
I always enjoy if there is some really interesting legal ruling or legal issue talking about it, because it's usually really fascinating stuff. And there is one that is out in the last couple days. At least I think it is, because I have read it and I have reread it and I've tried to read the short version of it, and I'm still not sure I understand what this is. I know my next guest will. Essentially, what this is, as I understand it, and he will correct me in a moment if I don't have this right, is there was a ruling about a sexual assault in which the judge applied, I guess, what we would call common sense expectations of human behavior. And the appeals court said, no, you can't apply regular patterns of behavior and expect that those are necessarily going to follow. But these were like pretty standard behavioral patterns, you would think. Anyway, let me bring in Jeff Banishan. He's a criminal lawyer, former Crown attorney. He is a man who has tried, through a great email he sent me, to explain this. And Jeff, I apologize, but my legalese and my legal knowledge clearly doesn't rise to the level that I was going to pass the bar. Explain this to me and everyone else, because I'm still confused by what they're saying here.
Sure, and you and me both, Scott, it's not an easy one. I've always done my best to try and keep legal principles as clear as possible when we discuss them. And I think, you know, to a good extent, I've been able to do it. But this one is like a thicket.
It
almost feels like the judges are tying themselves in knots to try and get to one conclusion, which might look on the face of it like it's inconsistent with another. And the conclusion they arrive at basically upholds convictions or restores convictions for sexual assault offenses, where there have been other cases in which they've reversed acquittals for reasoning you might have thought, well, wait a minute, how can you reverse those acquittals? So we'll deal with it on what the court had to consider. Actually, it was two separate trials in B.C., and the accused in each of them was convicted. And in one case, one of the reasons that the judge said for him convicting, and the accused denied having had intercourse with the woman, he said she was simply drunk, may well have been confused. She said, no, I did feel penetration in my vagina. And the judge said, well, a woman wouldn't be mistaken on a thing like that. Well, the Court of Appeal for BC said, well, hang on, how can you say that? You can't necessarily, if you haven't got any expert evidence, you haven't any basis for that, how can you sort of draw that conclusion? And what the Supreme Court of Canada said was, no, the Court of Appeal was wrong. It was open for the judge to draw that, make that kind of assumption, even without any evidence to support it. So that was trial and appeal and reversal number one. And trial number two, part of the evidence, the accused said that the complainant consented, and that she consented to some spanking activity, and that when he left afterwards, fairly quickly afterwards, it wasn't to get away, he simply left. And the trial judge said, oh, I find it hard to believe she would have consented to this. Oh, if he had left right after, well, that's more consistent with non-consensual activity than consensual. So he convicts. And the Court of Appeals said, just a minute, how can you draw those conclusions? You know, you're just assuming those things. They're really right, and there isn't evidence to sort of support that. And the Supreme Court of Canada says, nope. Trial judge was, even if he was wrong, it wasn't what we call a palpable and overriding error. That was the test. It wasn't a palpable and overriding error in his reasons, so the Court of Appeals shouldn't have reversed it, and they restored the conviction. They said it was a palpable error, but it wasn't an overriding error. I don't know where I'd draw the line, but it's a challenge. So that's the history of these cases, and defense counsel like me are going, well, wait a sec. I thought there was a real problem with judges drawing assumptions, saying, well, this is just common sense when maybe it isn't so common.
So in one case, common sense was not allowed to be used because that would have just been a generalization. And in the other one, common sense was allowed to be used, or at least an expectation of normal behavior.
Actually, Scott, close. In the first one, judge said, oh, this is, he basically was using some common sense. Court of Appeals said wrong. Supreme Court of Canada said not wrong. Second case, same kind of thing. Oh, you know, I would believe that this is more likely to indicate non-consent. Court of Appeal goes, just a minute, this driving away doesn't mean that. Supreme Court of Canada says, no, trial judge, even if he was wrong, it wasn't that bad an error.
So part of the thing, part of the criticism that has fallen on these rulings, as I understand it, has been that in recent years, one of the things that the Supreme Court or Court of Appeals, I'm not sure which, I think it was Supreme Court, said was, a woman's sexual history and past sexual behavior cannot be used as a guideline to what may have happened. Because she may have had many partners, you can't say then that whatever. And a lot of people, many people, most people probably applauded that and said, yeah, you can't make a generalization of past behavior equals current or future behavior. But is that not kind of flying in the face then of what they're saying about defendants in these cases?
You're in the right neighborhood. We'll take that and extend it a little bit, Scott. The issue of not being able to lead evidence to show women had sexual activity with others or even with the accused on other occasions, you can't use that to show she's more likely to have consented this time or less worthy of belief. That was the law the Supreme Court of Canada said, and it was enacted into the criminal code. Because you can't, it would really be a kind of myth to say, oh, well, if she consented to other people, she's less credible or more.
Right, she said yes that time.
That's just a myth. We're not going to allow that kind of reasoning.
Right, she said yes that time, so obviously she would say yes every time. That doesn't follow.
Yeah, and so that wouldn't be we aren't going to allow that kind of reasoning. And there was another issue of did the victim, we should say, could be man or woman, didn't complain at the first opportunity. Scott, years ago when I was a Crown, when you didn't have a complaint made at the first reasonable opportunity, a recent complaint, a jury would be told that that's a circumstance going against the credibility of the complainant. It was called the rule in relation to recent complaint. Well, that rule was abrogated. It was taken out because it happens that people can be sexually assaulted and don't complain right away, and it doesn't make them less worthy of belief. But what we have is a body of law that's developed where the courts have said there's a series of approaches that defense might have tried to argue that the courts said, oh, that's a myth, that's a stereotype, you can't use that to acquit. You can't use that to disbelieve the victim. Things like an argument, well, should there be some real physical injuries? If there aren't, what does that say? Does it suggest maybe that the victim consented? Or if a victim might well, an argument well, if a victim who may have said no, that doesn't necessarily mean no, it could have meant yes. Well, that's considered to be a myth or a stereotype. If the complainant was passive or didn't resist, well, that's a myth. That doesn't help in terms of consent, no consent. There's a whole host of other areas, too. How the complainant dressed. Oh, well, if the complainant dressed provocatively, that would undermine credibility. No, that's a myth. The fact of the victim didn't resist or cry out, that suggestive consent, no, that's a myth. There's a whole lot of different challenges. The fact that the complainant afterwards associated with the accused or didn't avoid him afterwards, if the defense suggestion is, well, that could indicate there was consent, no, that's a myth. That doesn't help on the idea of no assault. All those different issues, the courts have said, no, things that you and I, some of them, maybe, you and I might have thought, well, they're could be a common sense use for that. Nope, can't use it for that. It's a myth.
So we got to jump in, Jeff, because unfortunately we're really short on time. But I want to ask you this then. Some of the critics have said what this is doing is making it unfair to defendants because they can't apply a defense, and some of the things that they might have been able to apply they're not allowed to do now, but their behavior can be seen more generally. I mean, do the people who are saying this creates problems to be fair to defendants, do they have a case?
I think the way that we'd say it is the courts are ultra cautious to make sure that a complainant isn't disbelieved because of some what might be considered to be a common sense assumption. And yet, an accused could be disbelieved. An accused could be convicted. A complainant's evidence could be accepted for other common sense assumptions that might not have been backed up in the evidence. The position is it's not really a fair playing field. And the Supreme Court of Canada has made it harder for the defense to succeed and made it harder for appellate courts to reverse decisions by trial judges who might have relied upon what are called unfounded assumptions. Convicting on the basis of an unfounded assumption, the Supreme Court has made it far harder to reverse that conviction.
It is, it's a fascinating thing. I'm sure we'll hear about this at some point because somebody is going to have this go one way or another, and it'll either be complaint. Well, it's an interesting one, but it is very complicated. Jeff Manishin, criminal lawyer. I always love having you on, Jeff. Thanks for doing this today.
Thanks, Scott. A particularly tough one. And we remember credibility is so key to these trials. These are things that could shift the balance.
No question. Appreciate you doing this. Thank you.
Absolutely. Bye.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
It's your birthday, we're here to party and sing to you. From the Gulf to the mountains, the city lights and fountains.
Yeah, our next guest. It's his birthday today. I didn't even know that when I said you want to come on the show. He has taken time away from his celebrations, and I'm sure they are majestic, to join us. His name is Bubba O'Neill from CHCH. How are you?
I'm feeling like a Mexican hot dance.
Happy birthday.
Thank you very much.
I had no idea when I got in touch with you today and said, come on, I you know, I might have felt, I don't know, guilty about having you do this instead of, I don't know, whatever you do for your birthday these days.
You know what? This is actually the first day in recent memory that I've actually worked on my birthday.
Is that right?
But but it's rounded off in the sense that I'm not working tomorrow. So an extended weekend. It all ends up working in the end.
So you'll be staying up late tonight watching a whole series of something on Netflix to celebrate your birthday and you know, sipping on something. And, you know, it'll be a late night.
I hear lots about this Love is Blind, so I might venture into that.
I don't know. Try Love on the Spectrum. It's a great, fun show, and I'm serious. It's about people with autism trying to find love, and it sounds like it's mean. It's not mean at all. It's actually a lovely, lovely show. If you're going to do something on like a dating show, I would suggest that one is the one.
Really?
I'm telling you, you will love it. You will love it. Anyway. Hey, did you see what happened? We got to talk a few things here, but did you see what happened just about half an hour ago at Indian Wells in the tennis match?
I did not see.
They had to call off a match between two guys because an enormous invasion of bees took over center court. The play has been suspended due to what was described by the center court umpire as a bee invasion, and the video of this is unbelievable. It's apocalyptic. There are just bees everywhere. People are scrambling to get out. The guys on the court are running for their lives. It's millions of bees descended on center court all of a sudden.
That is actually just wild.
It is. I've never seen anything like it. And they've got the one camera. They've got the overhead camera that now can move. It's like on CFL fields or NFL fields where it moves around, and the live shot, the bees are climbing on the lens. It looks like a Hitchcock film.
I'm scared. That kind of stuff scares me.
It's just bizarre. I've never heard of anything like this. I mean, remember a few years ago, it was, what was his name? Who was the big, giant New York Yankees pitcher? Not CC Sabathia, the other guy who was the reliever. I'll think of his name in a second. And there were like gnats or something that descended on Yankee Stadium to the point where it was so distracting.
Oh, yeah.
They had to take a break. I can't remember his name. I'll think of it in a second. But they stopped the game because the players were being covered in gnats. But this is different. No one died from a gnat sting that I know of.
Dangerous. I mean, I see they're calling it, they're officially calling it a bee invasion.
Yeah, yeah. After you're done, go look on YouTube or Twitter or wherever. And Joba Chamberlain was the guy, the pitcher who was on the mound, and he was a large human being. He was a very large. There was a lot of surface area for gnats to cover, and they covered every square centimeter of him. And very, very strange story. Anyway, speaking of strange stories, I want to ask you this one because this is one of the great debates in sports. I'm sure you heard this yesterday. So the Colorado Avalanche were playing against the Vancouver Canucks, and Nikita Zadorov, who's a player on the Canucks, was asked, who's the best player in the league? Who's the guy that you say is the best player in the league? And he said, I'm not taking Connor McDavid. I'm not taking Austin Matthews. I'm taking Nathan MacKinnon of the Avalanche, and I'll tell you why. Because he is a winner. He has won a Stanley Cup. And I know there's been debates about this stuff forever, about NFL quarterbacks and that. How much does winning a championship in your mind change, especially in a team sport? It's got to be in a team sport. If it's individual, it goes without saying. But in a team sport, how much does winning a championship factor into whether or not a guy's the best player?
You know, that's a tough discussion because you're looking at a guy like Dan Marino, right? Who, in my opinion, when it comes to technical abilities of stepping up in the pocket, throwing the ball, quick release, putting balls where it has to be for the receiver to catch, I still to this day believe there's no one better I've ever seen, at least in my time, than Dan Marino. But he's a guy that does not have a Super Bowl title. So, of course, when you think about the greatest quarterbacks of all time, you somehow default to Super Bowls when it comes to football. You think of Tom Brady. You think of Joe Montana. You think of Brett Favre and John Elway. John Elway is actually a perfect example for this discussion because he went to a Super Bowl 3 times early in his career and was 0-for-3. But yet he never got his flowers until he won the 2 in the last 2 years of his career. So I think there is something to be said for that. I mean, our guy down the road, I mean, Jim Kelly is in the Hall of Fame, and rightfully so for his accomplishments. But when you say greatest quarterbacks of all time, his name is generally missing from this discussion. So I think there is something to having a championship.
I always come back to one particular guy, and you mentioned Marino and Kelly and others. And my question always is, so you're saying if you believe that a championship is what separates the men from the boys, essentially, that if you were starting a football team and everybody was in their prime, you would not take Dan Marino, but you would take Elvis Gerback. Because he won a championship. So that would mean that because he won a championship, somehow he is a better player because he's a winner. Well, that seems to be rather like defeating the argument immediately. As soon as you invoke the name Elvis Gerback, it seems like it's over, doesn't it?
When did Elvis Gerback win a Super Bowl?
He won Super Bowl 29. Super Bowl champion, Super Bowl 29, which was, he won it with the San Francisco 49ers.
Was he the starting quarterback?
No, hold on a second. That's not the right one. He is Super Bowl champion 29, yeah. Anyway, Elvis Gerback. Yes, he won a Super Bowl championship. And he was in the Pro Bowl one time.
But I think the guys that I named there won multiples, right? And that's where I think the difference is. Because you're right, people can catch a flyer. You think of Trent Dilfer, right? All you have to do is hand the ball off, right? At the Baltimore Ravens because the defense is so dominant. But I think in the examples that I use there, I talk about a guy that's, like Montana's 4-for-4, Tom Brady's 7-for-10, right? So I think when you're looking about basketball, the same thing. Michael Jordan, 6-for-6. LeBron James, 4-for-10, I think, actually.
Yeah, and by the way, Elvis Gerback was the Baltimore Ravens in 2001. But you go back to that point. So if the argument is that a winner is a guy who has won a championship, and if you haven't won a championship, you can't be considered a winner. By that description, Jim Kelly was not a winner. But if Scott Norwood doesn't hook the ball right for the Buffalo Bills, if that one kick doesn't go right, something that Jim Kelly had nothing to do with, he had nothing, he wasn't on the field when that kick happened, but that wide right kick changes Jim Kelly from being a winner to not a winner?
Well, some would say that when he had the ball, when he was driving the ball down the field, he could have, advanced the ball into a better situation for Scott Norwood, because anyone that's a kicker would tell you a 48-yard field goal on grass is never a guarantee, especially in a Super Bowl situation. So some would say that he should have done a better job of driving the offense closer to make up for a more makeable field goal.
Okay, let's use another example for the Bills then. So 3 or 4 years ago, whatever it was, Josh Allen leads the Bills down with 13 seconds left, scores a touchdown. So he does everything he possibly could have done. There is nothing else that he could have done. He didn't leave the ball on the field. He didn't lose points, whatever. And the Buffalo Bills defense allows the Kansas City Chiefs to march down the field in 13 seconds to score. Buffalo might have won the Super Bowl that year with the team they had and the way they were playing. So does that mean Josh Allen is not a winner for something that didn't happen, that happened when he was not on the field and he had nothing to do with?
Now, I wouldn't use the word winner, but I will say this to that discussion, because we saw it again this year. What's his kryptonite? What's Josh Allen's kryptonite?
His defense.
His kryptonite is the other guy, the guy that plays his position on the other side of the field. And whether people like the guy or not, he's now established himself as, you know, arguably the greatest quarterback of this era right now. So that's the guy that's standing in his way, because I think this is where we're going with this, is that you hear it all the time, is that when you, as I used Elway as the example, he will never get his flowers until you win the Super Bowl or lead your team to the Super Bowl, right? And I think that is a difference. I mean, there's something to be said. What do these guys play the game for? You know, a guy like McKinnon was the best player on that team, on a team that won a title, and that's why you play the game. It's to win championships. I mean, and let's be honest too. There's got to be said something to be said for the word, you know, that old phrase about it's a team game, and you win as a team and you lose as a team.
And I'll go back to another example, because I think that Zadorov, I think he's lost the narrative here, because take Paul Coffey, for example, not Paul Coffey, Ray Bourque, same era. Would Ray Bourque have been considered not a winner if he hadn't got that trade to go to Colorado and win a Stanley Cup? I would say Ray Bourque was absolutely a winner. I don't think that Stanley Cup, I know that Ray Bourque loved to win that Stanley Cup and loved to have the ring and loved that experience, but I don't think that changed a thing for him in his legacy. I think he was established. If he had remained a Boston Bruin until the end, I don't think it changes a thing about how we think of him.
You know what the funny thing is about that, Scott? When you watch videos and they talk about, I'll use exactly the guy they're talking about, they always say that the cup, of course, with all the years of the nearly two decades he put in with the Boston Bruins, it becomes somewhat of an afterthought, because he needed that Stanley Cup to be considered amongst the greatest. And that's the thing. You can put up all the records and all the stats you want, but to be the ultimate winner, you got to win the cup.
The challenge, though, with any of this debate is I am very happy to have this discussion if we're talking about Tiger Woods or some other golfer, because it's all on you. It's entirely on you what happens then. You are solely responsible. But there's lots of guys who have played for crappy teams that never were given the chance because of nothing that they did wrong. But is it then somehow there, would you not take them? I mean, go down the list of anybody who's never won a cup. If you were drafting among the all-time great goalies, some of those guys never won a cup. Would you not take them then because they didn't win a cup? I would. There's a bunch
maybe
of guys.
Would you not take
Curtis Joseph?
Well, I was never a huge Joseph fan, but I'll tell you one guy that I can think of that works in this discussion. What's the one thing I think that holds back Jeremy Roenick from being amongst the greats, maybe even being in the Hall of Fame?
His mouth?
No,
sometimes.
No, well, I mean, yeah, no, there's lots of guys with mouth.
No, but it is.
Fame, right? But he never won. Never won a title.
Yeah, I think it's so overrated.
I don't know. I don't know if you asked those guys about winning a championship being overrated.
No. You know, not winning a championship, grading it, making it part of your resume as it determines whether you're great or not.
It's an important part of your resume that you won. Think about Walter Payton, arguably definitely the greatest running back of his era, and one still to this day that gets named in his era, but it's only until the end, in his last dying, you know, his last days. He played for lousy, horrible teams,
yes,
and put up spectacular numbers. But the crowning jewel in the thing was get Walter that Super Bowl.
Yeah, and then when they finally could, they ran the ball. They gave the ball to Refrigerator Perry to run it in for a touchdown from the 1 yard line.
We'll argue about that forever, because I thought, you know, that, you know, many people think that was a disgrace and a disrespect.
Still
for
do.
Him. You know, that conversation is definitely alive and well still many years later. But I think there's something to be said about that when you get that title in a team sport.
And again, I'll go back to Zadorov's thing. There is not a – well, maybe there is. I mean, look, there is an argument to be made, not just because of the cup. I mean, you can have a legitimate disagreement or discussion about who do you like better among those three guys, McKinnon, Matthews, McDavid. There's something about guys whose names start with M, apparently. If your last name starts with M, you're good to go. But I don't think that there is a single... Would you think there would be one general manager in the NHL if they had a draft today and you could take anybody? Is there one guy who would not take McDavid first?
I don't know.
I doubt it.
I don't know. Like, you mean... Like, Nathan McKinnon has been a great player and has done so
for a long time. Sure he has.
He's lived up. I mean, he's leading the league in points now. Like, it appears to me that the way things are going right now, that Austin Matthews, I thought if Austin Matthews got the 70 goals, it's a lock that he wins the Hart Trophy as the league MVP. I might give it to McKinnon right now.
No question. He might win that this year and he would be full of measure for it. As I say, to me, it's just the whole championship thing to me gets overblown. And I'll give you the absolute. So you mentioned Dan Marino. I would agree that he is certainly maybe the one of the best examples. The other guy I would say also comes from football. You're telling me that Barry Sanders was somehow not a winner? Now, he was saddled with an atrocious Detroit Lions team most of the time he was there, but he would be probably in the top two or three or four at most running backs of all time. I don't think that not having a championship changes that.
It doesn't. It doesn't in some ways, but I still think didn't lead his team, or like as good as he was, as outstanding as he was, and the amazing things he did, especially for a guy his size. I just think that it's not that he's the obvious Hall of Famer. But if you ask him what's the thing he most dislikes about his career or whatever, he'd tell you. Like there's a feature out there, one of those NFL features. Like it burns Dan Marino that he never won a Super Bowl.
Yep.
It kills him. It kills him. Right? He threw away every statistic he had when he walked away from the game. He had every significant passing record in the National Football League. I'm sure, I've heard the man say it to the camera, how much he would trade in all of that for one Super Bowl. That's how much those guys desire to win that one title.
It's a fascinating one. It's a fascinating one about how much does a championship change the definition of you as an athlete and you as a winner. You know what? Certainly we're not going to, everyone's got their opinion, and that's great. I think it's one of those great have a coffee, have a beer, whatever discussions with your buddies that you can have about does it change your overall view. As I say, for me, it doesn't. For me, it's if you were one of the greats, I consider you a winner, whether you got that championship or not, if you're in a team sport, because a lot of it is out of your hands. What if you are a great athlete, even with great athletes around you, but you've got a crappy coach, which happens at times too? I mean, that's some of these things are just out of your control. Listen, not out of your control is what happens tonight because it is Bubba's birthday. So listen, I hope you will have a fantastic birthday. I know that this year you're turning 35, and you know what? I remember 35 as a fantastic year. And I'm sure the good folks at CHCH, they're having a special tonight after the news just about the life of Bubba O'Neill, right? There's something like that.
Somehow it got scrapped.
Oh, it got usurped. It got preempted for some infomercial. It's a special with the Frank Show, the Being Frank Show. They've got a special version of that that's coming on tonight.
Frank Show. Give it some credit. Give it at least it got trend. It got bumps for trending now.
Okay, all right. Hey, listen, happy birthday, and it was not quite 35, but listen, happy birthday. Thanks for doing this today.
I always appreciate you. Thank you.
The Scott Radley Show, weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode. And also, be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.